Hey again, Medical Education Podcast listeners. This is Kevin Eva, the editor-in-chief of the journal. I have the pleasure today of speaking with one of the very few second-time guests on podcast. As you can probably tell if you listen regularly, I do try to spread out the chance to talk with a variety of different people, but every now and then a paper comes up that is just too irresistible to me. So I have gone back to the well a second time in this instance and will enjoy speaking with Edward Krupat, who's recently retired as director of the Center for Evaluation at Harvard Medical School and also has a continuing appointment in the Department of Medicine at Beth Israel Hospital in Boston. Thank you, Ed, for doing this twice.
My pleasure.
As you know, you have a paper coming out in the November 2017 issue of Medical Education called Avoiding Premature Closure and Reaching Diagnostic Accuracy, Some Key Predictive Factors. I will start by reminding some of our listeners that there's a tremendous history of trying to better understand the diagnostic process. In fact, I think it's one of the domains in which the field, as we know it, was really built. And so I guess maybe the best place to start is to say, given all that has come before this and the extensive work that's gone into trying to understand what is it that drives clinical decision making and how we might teach that, what hole did you see that was left over that you felt needed filled with further study?
Well, it's a hole with two parts. I mean, the first is that I think there's still a lot of inconsistency and uncertainty about exactly what factors are most important, what aspects of bias, what cognitive factors determine whether people get accurate diagnoses, and also how they go about getting from the point of a presenting symptom and a presenting patient to making a diagnosis at all. So I think each of us always feels that he or she can fill in part of the void. And the other thing is we designed a method that we thought could get at a lot of these things simultaneously that we hadn't seen in the literature before. So we were excited about testing that out and seeing if it could generate valid results.
The notion of premature closure, I assume to be something that most of our listeners will be familiar with, but just in case, can I ask you to elaborate on what aspect of diagnostic challenge you were hoping to address?
By all means. I think very often people worry that physicians kind of grab on to a single diagnosis at first from basically knowing patterns that they see and pick up something. And as a couple of psychologists referred to, what they do is they seize a diagnosis. And then once they do that, they engage in kind of a search for confirming information. And that is, so to speak, they freeze on that diagnosis with the idea that as new information comes in, they may discount it or they may not seek out information that could possibly disconfirm a hypothesis, a diagnosis. And as a result, they get it wrong because they don't pay enough attention to all the information in totality.
It's a difficult concept to study in many ways because it's only really noticeable when something goes wrong, and often the label is applied in hindsight. When that early information leads to the right diagnosis, generally it wouldn't be noticed. So how did you go about defining or feeling confident that it was premature closure that you were actually looking at?
Well, simply because what we did is define the cases that the clinicians encountered in such a way that initially, the information that we fed to the participants in our study consistently pointed in a direction that would allow you to begin to feel more and more certain. Except at a certain point along the way, we introduced a piece of information that we thought, again, it's one of these things where I'd love to have a visual because what I'm going to do is kind of pull back, if you could see me, and say, that's interesting. That I've got to rethink this. Or that's not a typical presentation. Or could I be wrong? All of these things we would imagine clinicians would stop and say to themselves. But the evidence suggests that it doesn't happen all the time or it doesn't happen as much as we'd like it to happen.
And so you were looking for those moments where that disconfirming information, you know, led somebody to stop and think again in many ways. How did you actually measure or observe or capture that phenomenon through the data that you were collecting?
Well, you'll tell me if I'm getting into too much detail on the method, but so any participant would have, let's say, a given case, encounter a basic presentation from a patient in a couple of sentences, and then be asked, number one, to list as many items on his or her differential as desired, and two, for each item on the differential, to indicate a level of certainty from 0 to 100. And again, that didn't have to add up to 100, but each one independently. And after that, we simply said to them, are you ready to announce your diagnosis or would you like more information? After that first one, everybody wanted more information. Along came some other information, whether more reports of symptoms, whether family history, whether personal history, whatever, a diagnostic test. Once you got that information, you got the opportunity, again, to add or delete items on your differential and to change the levels of certainty. Got the same choice. Do you want to keep on going? Well, in general, most people wanted to keep on going, but you could guess that after a few of these, they were beginning to get down to it. On step five, which we called for ourselves informally the stopper or formally the disconfirming information step, we introduced the piece of information that was meant to make people stop and rethink a little bit. And at that point, again, they have the choice of stopping at any point, changing their differential and their levels of certainty at any point. But this could go on as many as 10 steps, at which point the diagnosis was called. So we had the opportunity to see how certain they were, what they were thinking before the disconfirming information occurred, and then whether they changed after their levels of certainty, what went on to and off of their differentials.
And as the title implies, some key predictive factors, you know, the purpose of this work seems to have been in large part to try to better understand what things do influence that tendency to be willing to entertain other possibilities after being led a certain distance along the garden path. What would you highlight as some of the key findings that were most interesting to you?
We looked at three categories of variables. One was aspects of the differential, and that is how many items did they place on the differential, on the average, on the first step, how certain were they? And it turns out that the number of items of diagnoses considered on the average was a predictor of accuracy. Second category was persistence, and that is how many steps along the way to these 10 did they continue to ask for information? And in general, the more steps that were, the more information that was called for, the less likely wanting to quit early was also predictive of accuracy. And then finally, we looked at openness to disconfirmation, and that is switching. And I think you've written a wonderful paper called Switching Horses at Midstream. We were asking, did you change your diagnosis? Did you switch? And that was also predictive. So especially persistence and openness to change, to disconfirmation, were clearly associated with getting it right.
And noticeable by its absence in the list that you just gave is, you know, something to do with the participants themselves. You report that the level of experience was not predictive. Was that surprising? Do you have any explanation as to why the more experienced, presumably the better clinicians, would not have performed their more junior counterparts?
Well, yeah, that, you know, initially, naively, we said, well, this will be a straightforward enough study to demonstrate that senior clinicians, and that is attendings that we were studying, compared to the second year residents at that hospital, compared to third year medical students, well, we'll find a clear differentiation. The more experienced they are, the better they'll get it. But what we found is, on average, those three did not differ in their levels of accuracy, but they did differ stylistically somewhat, such that it seemed like the senior clinicians were falling prey to the factors associated with premature closure, and that is starting narrow, starting short in their differentials, and not being as quick to switch. And it made us realize it's far more, at least based on our findings and others, a matter of style of processing than how long you've been practicing.
So it's a good reminder, again, that having a certain amount of experience isn't necessarily what drives one's approach, and experience isn't alone a good marker for expertise in terms of the quality of one's performance on tasks like these. Given the factors that you did identify that were related and those that maybe unanticipatedly were not, where does this lead you in terms of how you're going to try to coach and encourage better diagnostic decision-making amongst those of all levels?
Well, one of the things that I'd like to say, and we didn't talk about it at length in the paper, but if I can here as an extension of that, is the idea of people seeing and finding how others think. By analogy, I remember the first time I went to dinner at somebody else's house, I found out that some people talked about politics. And I could never have imagined, because my family never did talk about that over dinner. And I said, you mean there are other ways than how I think of something? I think if you put three medical students or three clinicians or whomever in a room and had them do this, commit to their answers simultaneously, and then compare and find out that others may or may not think alike, that it may, I'd like to think, and that would be a next step that I'd like to take using this technique that we've come up with, a way of opening people's eyes and making them understand and recognize that either they are falling prey to certain biases, that they are looking at things too narrowly or too quickly. And I think that awareness can help people really begin to understand and gain insight into their own diagnostic styles.
Very interesting. And again, reinforcing to keep in mind that there is no one strategy that's always going to be more effective than another, and fundamentally I think has a lot of implications in terms of how we think about diagnostic processing and whether or not we should be trying to push people any one direction or another. Maybe the outcome of much of this is raising awareness in terms of the variety of approaches that could be beneficial rather than treating anything as absolute.
I agree with you fully. And this one study, we, as you asked initially, how did it come that people should be rethinking? Well, we made sure to write the cases that way. But we all know that it may be that getting too much information may slow you down. Getting too much information may have cost in terms of not only time, but unnecessary diagnostic testing. Sometimes, by the way, that quick first answer may be right, but it's clearly not right every time. And again, I think, as you suggested, that people become aware of options and ways of when to slow down and when not to, and whether to slow down and why to slow down, becomes a set of lessons that clinicians at any stage in their careers would find useful.
And that leads me to a question that I think I'll end on, which is one of the criticisms of work like this in general can be that, you know, you've established a situation that bears a lot of resemblance to real world decision making, but in the real world the clinician would have a lot more control over what they collected in a given moment and wouldn't be prompted even quite as easily to say, do you want more information? With that in mind, where do you think the boundaries are in terms of what implications you're eager to draw from this, and what do you think needs to be done in order to make sure that these lessons you've learned translate well to the real world?
Well, this method we use, which we call the DCAT, the Decision Certainty Analysis Tool, is DCAT 1.0. One of the things that I think you implied strongly is that they get the information in the way, the nature of the information and the order of information in the way that we've chosen, it's standardized, and that's not how the real world operates. What I'd love to do, I don't know if I'm dating myself by talking about kids' make your own adventure books. What ideally we do is have, at step one, patient walks in and offers some basic presenting symptoms, and then we say, what do you want next? Because maybe after all is said and done, learning how people deal with predetermined information may be less important than finding out what information they seek out rather than how they process it once we give it to them. So if we can find a way of programming this situation such that we allow everybody to go in their own direction, and then finding some way of standardizing the comparison so you can actually draw some statistical conclusions, I think that's when we and the rest of the field will be at whatever 2.4, but we're not there yet.
It's a very promising note to end on, though, so we will look forward to seeing DCAT 2.0 or 2.4 or 3.0 or whatever comes next. Yeah. But I'll just close by reminding our listeners that we've been speaking about a paper called Avoiding Premature Closure and Reaching Diagnostic Accuracy, Some Key Predictive Factors, that will come out in the November 2017 issue of Medical Education under the author name Edward Krupat. And I should also acknowledge, Ed, that you flew across the country last night to get home after visiting some very young twin grandchildren. So thank you in particular for being available on such a jet-lagged schedule, as I'm sure you're feeling right now.
My pleasure.